Good morning to each and every one of you. The Senate Rules Committee is being convened at this moment. It is Wednesday, January 24th, approximately 1:40 p.m. Madam Secretary, when we establish a quorum by calling the roll.
Senators Atkins.
Here.
Atkins here. Berryhill.
Here.
Berryhill here. Leyva.
Here.
Leyva here. Canella.
Here.
Canella here. De Leon.
Here.
De Leon here.
Thank you very much, Madam Secretary. Colleagues, let's work the file before us. I'm going to take files item number 2 through 5. File items number 2 through 5, as well as 7 through 9. Okay, we have a motion made by Ms. Leyva. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Senators Atkins.
I'm sorry,
2 through 5 and 7 through 9. 2 through 5 and 7 through 9, yes.
Atkins, aye. Berryhill.
Aye.
Berryhill, aye. Leyva.
Aye.
Leyva, aye. Canella.
Aye.
Canella, aye. De Leon.
Aye.
De Leon, aye.
Thank you very much, colleagues. Motion passes. We are going to go to our first member that is required to appear before us. That is Mr. Juan Pedro Gaffney, a member of ABC, the Alcoholic Beverage Control Appeals Board. Welcome.
Thank you.
Why don't we do this? Why don't you give us a synopsis of your person? If there's anyone that you'd like to introduce, please do so, and then we'll go to a short statement, and then we'll go to questions and answers.
Sounds good.
Thank you very much.
I'm Juan Pedro Gaffney Rivera, native of San Francisco's Mission District, and by that token, from a multicultural background. After a 40-year career in community music came to a close a few years ago, I looked for other ways to serve the community at large. And learning about the work of this board, the Board of Appeals of ABC, I applied to serve on it, bringing an ordinary citizen's skill set and perspective to its work with the department to assure a fair and equitable application of law for the benefit of all. That's why I'm here.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gaffney. Colleagues, questions or commentaries for Mr. Gaffney, Rivera, and we go with Ms. Leyva.
Thank you, Mr. Pro Tem. Good afternoon. Thank you for being here. I just have one question. I know you're new to this position, but do you think that the existing laws and regulations are sufficiently discouraging underage drinking?
I do. From what I've been able to observe, the procedures of the department in governing sales has been, I think, quite effective. The department sends agents on a supervisory capacity looking for infractions. And the infractions, once noted, are brought before law. And what we receive, of course, are appeals from the licensee that said, oh, it was not a fair shake, or the penalty was too severe. But in point of fact, the protocols are necessary to see to it that alcohol does not reach underage intenders.
Very good. Thank you. That's all, Mr. Pro Tem.
Thank you very much, Ms. Leyva. Mr. Berryhill. Thank you very much, Ms. Atkins.
Thank you. It's good to see you. This may get a little community oriented, but having served at the local level, I've always, I get a lot of comments from applicants, whether they are applying to get a license, a new one, or to change a license. I'm just curious, in the time that you've been there, what you've noticed as it relates to the standard time for processing a case from a date of an appeal that it is received is about 9 months, and during that time, the licensee can continue to operate. What about a new license? If a new license is denied, that's a new business. What's the timeline? Do you know? And I can also call the...
We haven't had a case, we have not had a case of that character.
Okay.
In my tenure on the board. So I personally don't have an experience of that situation. I can ask counsel on staff to
I can follow up. Just from your perspective, at the local level, we're always dealing with this balance in the world, which is over-concentration, you know, in terms of the number of licenses, alcohol licenses, and then you also have the issue of new businesses and businesses that want to start, and how important it is that businesses not be delayed if, you know, they want to. So I know that you're the local ABC folks and investigators are always having to balance that dilemma between communities and support for business. So I was just curious from your perspective, since you're here, but that was my only very simple question, not some profound overreaching thing, but I appreciate your response.
I'm happy to pursue the question with staff.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Atkins. Mr. Vice Chair.
No questions.
Thank you very much. Those individuals who are in support of today's nominee, Mr. Juan Pedro Gaffney Rivera, for those who are in support. Seeing none, those who are in opposition, Mr. Pedro Gaffney Rivera. Seeing none, no other further questions or commentaries from the members. Seeing none, can I entertain a motion? We have a motion made by Mr. Vice Chair. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Senators Atkins?
Aye.
Atkins, aye. Berryhill?
Aye.
Berryhill, aye. Leyva?
Aye.
Leyva, aye. Cannella?
Aye.
Cannella, aye. De Leon?
Aye.
De Leon, aye.
Mr. Gaffney Rivera, felicidades. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Bringing old school back to the ABC. Okay, colleagues, next we have Mr. Brian E. Duffy, who's Associate Director of the Division of Adult Institutions, that's CDCR. Mr. Duffy, welcome. I think you may have ascertained from what I had, when I just spoke to Mr. Gaffney, if there's any folks you'd like to introduce, please do so. And then give us a synopsis of your person, and what we'll do is we'll go questions and answers by the members. Thank you, Mr. Duffy.
Here.
Okay, please. Yeah.
My mom, Joanne Duffy.
Welcome.
Wife,
who would your wife be? And, okay, I had nobody wanted to raise their hand and identify themselves as your wife, so, you know. Okay.
This is my brother Eric and his wife Patty.
Welcome.
My brother in law, Phil McCarthy. My son, Colin. And Gavin and his wife Alejandra.
Oh, wow. Okay, welcome. The Duffy clan is here, you know, no doubt. You know. So welcome.
First of all, I wanted to thank the governor for putting his trust in me in this position and for the senators on this committee for hearing me today. After roughly 25 years in state service, I retired a couple of years ago. And I retired a little bit too early due to some health reasons and other things that were going on. Things are changed and turned around, and I was lucky enough to get a phone call asking me to come back and to work, and I realized I'd left a little bit too early, and I'm excited to come back, and I'm energized and very much enjoying the position that I'm in now. I come from a family that worked in civil service, and I take a lot of pride in the work that I do. My goals within the Department of Corrections are to further our mission, and I represent the reception centers, which I am working diligently to ensure that our processing is smooth and quick, and also the fire camps to make sure that they're run smoothly and efficiently. And I look forward to answering your questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Duffy. Why don't we go to, we'll go with Ms. Leyva. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pro Tem. Good afternoon, Mr. Duffy. Thank you for being here. I enjoyed meeting with you and we had a long, extensive conversation. And as I shared with you, I have lived by two prisons for pretty much my whole life and didn't think much about them, probably not good, until I was elected. And I've now had the opportunity to try and be what I think is helpful in some situations. So I just had a few questions for you to follow up on some of the things we talked about yesterday. We talked a little bit about suicide and suicide prevention, and I was hoping that maybe you could share with all of us the suicide summit that was held in October.
So a lot of measures have been taken by the department to prevent suicides to the extent that we can. And as I told you yesterday, my way of thinking, one suicide is one too many. Within the department, we've done extensive training with staff. On my side, with the custody side of the house, we ensure that custody staff are going by cells at least twice an hour within our administrative segregation units and SHU units, which are, we have the higher concentration of those inmates that are having the stress and the issues. We do that by having them click a little wand against a button, and we check it, and it automatically records. So we're able to go back and ensure that staff are doing what they're supposed to do and looking in on the inmates. We also have started doing morning huddles, where we're meeting with mental health staff, talking about the different issues that are going on within the housing units. I think I mentioned with you yesterday, there used to be a lot of silos between mental health and medical, and we're trying to break those down, and we're trying to work as a team, doing a much better job of it. Things are changing, and we're working diligently.
In the morning huddles, that's something that is new?
Those are newer in a lot of places.
Okay. And the summit, I believe, the suicide summit, that was new as well?
It's the first one I'm aware of.
Okay, very good. That's great. You are ahead of, hold on, I've got too many notes here. Sorry, there we go, the Associate Director of Reception Centers. So what checks and balances are in place to ensure that inmates are correctly classified at the intake centers?
So an inmate is received from the counties. Once they hit the reception center, immediately upon getting there, they're interviewed by custody staff and by medical staff and mental health staff to ensure that we appropriately and safely house them upon intake. Then they go through a whole series of tests while they're in the reception center, including thorough medical and mental health histories. And also with the custody side, we're gonna run a battery of tests to make sure that we give them the right programs that they need, and also to look at some of their histories and they get what they need.
Okay, excellent. Do you think programming has changed and gotten better over the years?
Absolutely. When I started 25 years ago, there really was not much programming, if any. We've done a really good job of expanding it in all of our prisons, specifically in the reception centers. Even a couple years ago, there was very little programming for inmates. During that initial period, they're there for the 60 to 90 days. We now, in every one of our reception centers, have different programs for them to be involved in, whether it be self-help groups or criminal thinking, just different ways trying to improve them during that short period before we get them out to the programs within the institution they'll be spending their majority of their incarceration, where we've expanded on those programs.
And when the inmates are assigned to prisons, is there consideration given to proximity to family, especially inmates who have children?
We do our best to get the inmate as close to their families and maintain family reunification. Unfortunately, it's not always possible based on their custody level and the places where we have our different institutions. And sometimes the programs that they need and they're seeking might not be in the area. But we do take very much into consideration where they want to be and do the best we can to get them there.
And can their custody change and they could get moved?
Sure, absolutely. For instance, down in your district, you have a couple of lower level institutions, and they may be at a high level, want to get there. Over time, based on good behavior and participating in programs, their points will come down and we can get them there.
Excellent. I want to talk a minute about the fire service or the fire training. Do inmates who serve on the fire crews receive formal job training that they can then use to obtain employment once they serve their time?
Yes and no.
Okay.
So they're receiving training that will allow them to do wildland fire suppression at this point. We have within the governor's budget that's proposed right now, there is a program to expand the training for parolees, which would, once they have paroled from the fire camp, those that are the cream of the crop would be able to go to this camp and now learn additional skills to make them much more competitive in the community for firefighter jobs.
Very good. And what is the maximum amount of inmates that can participate in the program at one time?
Are you talking about current?
Current.
Current, about around 4,500.
Okay, and what is the number today?
We are around 3,500.
Okay, so there's still room to bring other
Absolutely.
Inmates? Okay, excellent. One last question. Thank you for your patience, Mr. Pro Tem. So last Sunday, January 21st, an inmate escaped from the California Institution of Men. No one was hurt, and the inmate was eventually captured. But the incident does raise questions about the security of the facility in Chino. What is the plan to address these security issues?
A number of items have already been addressed. For one, we put additional staff on the outside of the perimeter. The California Institution for Men had actually even started putting up brand new LED lighting on another yard and have the lights bought, but hadn't moved to the yard that the inmate left a little early from. They have actually started putting the lights up. And in addition, we've had a contract for 2 years we've been trying to get through, and we've just gotten through for a shaker fence, so it has a shaker alarm that will be repaired on January 29th. They'll be out to fix it.
So some of this was already in process.
Already in process.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for being willing to serve. No further
Thank
questions.
You. Thank you very much, Ms. Slava. Mr. Berryhill.
Thank you. I've got a couple questions on conservation camps. But my first question is, could you move over? I can't see you. And there's just two quick ones.
Yes, sir.
How do you expect Proposition 57 to impact conservation camp populations?
So what we've seen so far within Proposition 57, it has allowed those inmates that volunteer, it's a voluntary program to go, to get 2 days off their sentence for every day that they serve. So while we're losing inmates quicker, we're finding that more inmates are interested in the program. And so it's been a wash so far. We're staying fairly even, and it looks like we may be able to maintain it fairly.
Even with everybody that we have let go, we're still plenty of folks to help fight those fires?
Yes, our numbers have stayed almost exactly the same.
Okay, my last question is, what are you doing to protect the community and ensure the wrong type of inmate is not placed in the camp? What we don't want is, you know, out on all these fires when they're protecting homes and whatnot. If you could comment on that.
Sure. Generally, the inmates are, well, always, whenever an inmate is out in the community, they're being supervised by CAL FIRE staff and correctional staff. When they are anywhere near structures, they are required to be within line of sight, and we don't let them out of our sight. Prior to going out to the fire camps, we do a thorough violence review and do a case-by-case committee on each one of those inmates that would be going out to a fire camp. I'm happy to say that in the last few years, since I've been aware of it, we haven't had one incident.
Do you have any lost anybody on a fire?
We have had inmates who have walked away from the fire camps during the, yes, we've had that, but we haven't had any incidents involving the citizens that I'm aware of.
Okay, great, thank you. That's it, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Berryhill. Ms. Atkins. No catch? Okay, Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Pro Tem. We just met a few minutes ago, and you answered all my questions, but just on this firefighter training and certification program, again, it's, as we talked about, these are highly coveted positions. Of, you know, for one opening, there's hundreds, if not thousands, folks that apply. So I think it's great that we're going to give formerly incarcerated folks a skill, but is it realistic that they're going to get into the firefighting world? I mean, have you talked to CAL FIRE or individual fire departments about what are we going to do with all these folks that we get trained?
I've had some not in-depth discussions with CAL FIRE. I have had none with the local agencies. CAL FIRE currently has, as I understand it, roughly 5,000 seasonal jobs, which are highly coveted also, and a lot of people throughout the United States are trying to get those jobs. This training would make them a little bit more competitive for those jobs, or would make them competitive for those jobs with CAL FIRE. So there is some possibility that they would be, you know, able to be hired by CAL FIRE, where they're not right now with the training they have. They'd have to go to a community college and get it. So this, within this parole program, they would be competitive for those jobs. I'm not as familiar with how they would be competitive in the community.
So what we've seen in the past is we're trying to really work with folks that were incarcerated, give them a skill set so when they come out, they can make a living and hopefully not reoffend. But in some cases, the areas that they've been trained, they by law can't work in them. So have you checked around to see if CAL FIRE and local fire departments can hire formerly incarcerated folks?
What I have is anecdotal. I've been told that some fire departments can hire and some can't hire former felons.
That would be, if we're going to spend all this money to train somebody and they can't get the job.
I've been told that CAL FIRE can hire them for their seasonal workers, which is all.
So I guess they're part of the crews when there's fires, right? With the
Yes, they are.
Corps. Okay. All right. That's all my questions. Thank you
very much, Mr. Vice Chair. For those in the audience today who are in support of Mr. Duffy, we have a microphone for those who are in support of today's nominee. Seeing none, those in opposition. This is a moment for family members to come in opposition. If you want to take a, I think it was your brother or brother-in-law. Seeing no one in opposition, so we have Mr. Duffy. I think we've had a thorough, you know, examination of Mr. Duffy's credentials. So why don't we entertain a motion? We have a motion. It's been made by Ms. Leva. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Senators Atkins.
Aye.
Atkins, aye. Berryhill.
Aye.
Berryhill, aye. Leva.
Aye.
Leva, aye. Canella.
Aye.
Canella, aye. De Leon.
Aye.
De Leon, aye.
Mr. Duffy, congratulations. Okay, last we have on our agenda item is Ms. Karen Valdez, State Board Member of the State Board of Education. Welcome, Ms. Valdez. I think if there's anyone that you want to introduce, please do so and give us a quick synopsis of your person, and we'll go to questions and answers.
Certainly, thank you. I brought my husband, Manny Valdez, and my daughter, Carly Valdez, and my other daughter, Natalie Valdez.
Welcome.
I mean, they're married now. I apologize.
Okay.
Carly Pena and Natalie Mueller.
Okay, welcome.
They were Valdez girls before. I know, that's I thank you for the opportunity to meet with you today, and I also thank the senators for meeting with me individually. I've been in education for over 33 years and have been in public education, and I firmly believe that it is a pathway to a better life, and I feel like it is a calling to be in public education. I have the distinct pleasure now to serve as an assistant superintendent. Okay, I'm sorry. I have the distinct pleasure now to serve as an assistant superintendent in the Menifee Union School District, and as of next week, I'll be an assistant superintendent in the Hemet Unified School District. Prior to being on the state board this year, I served as a California Practitioner Advisory Group called CPAG as a transition team in helping the state board as they were making decisions with the new Every Student Succeeds Act. I'm the daughter of a Filipino immigrant, and I am the wife of a principal who has been an education, public education principal for over 25 years. Our eldest is an attorney, and our middle daughter is a teacher, and she's a new teacher, so I've been looking at that. And our youngest son, who is not here today, is starting his second semester at Cal State San Marcos. So I appreciate your support and your confidence in me, if possible, and I welcome the opportunity to serve the students and the families and the parents in California, and I look forward to responding to your questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Valdez. Why don't we start with Ms. Atkins? Nothing? Okay. Ms. Levia? Ms. Leva?
I'm actually pretty good, too. You interviewed so well. You have so much great history and background for this, but just a couple things. Do you think that LCFF is working?
I do, but it's a system, and the system takes time. So the four parts of it, the local control funding formula, as well as the local control accountability plan, identifying the priorities, and then having a way to report out through the dashboard is part of that system.
And do you think the accountability measures that are in place are adequate?
I think they are, and we're learning them along the way as well, because they're brand new.
Very good. Career technical education is something that's very near and dear to my heart. I think yours as well. We talked earlier about that. Is the board looking at a lack of career readiness information in the college and career readiness indicators?
We're still building the college and career indicator, and one of the areas that I think of focus is the career tech education and thinking about college and career opportunities for students. And so really defining that, and by defining it, we don't do it in isolation. We're bringing in all of the stakeholders and teachers and administrators and people who are experts in the area of career to really understand the different industry sectors and the pathways that the careers might offer. And we're actually even pushing it down in my own situation into the middle school grades, and we're beginning to offer CTE, California technical education courses at the middle school level to get them off to a great start.
That's great. That's really terrific. What do you hope to bring to your position? What is your vision for what you want to do?
Thank you. I think I'm, in some ways, I bring the policy to practice because I am living and breathing the policies and decisions that are made at the State Board. I live in my everyday day job. So I have that filter of, is it doable? Can it work? And how can we make it work as we're putting it into place?
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pro Tem.
Mr. Berryhill.
Thank you, and I'm going to, I hate to be repetitious, but yeah, could you move over also? I know this LCFF is still new and still getting going, so I understand that. But I do have a couple questions on what some of your beliefs are. Do you believe the current LCAP guidelines require enough budgetary information so parents can hold districts accountable for its LCFF spending? And I ask that question because of the $450 million in LA Unified and what was it, $36 million in Fresno that wasn't identified, and parents were very concerned about where that money is being spent.
So I do believe that it's working, and I also believe that it can get better. So in the cases that you're talking about and I'm noting, the template has changed so that there is more transparency with the summary section of the local control accountability template. There is an opportunity to be more transparent with parents, and it's more narrative, it's more friendly, so that you can just, it's kind of the summary section, so you can read that. But within the plan itself are the itemized items, and in the update section, it is, did you spend those dollars that you said you were going to spend?
Thank you. 5 months ago, I asked two of your fellow board members if the state would be ready to meet the requirement to report all federal, state, and local expenditures at the school site level for ESSA. This still got me concerned. You note in your response to the committee that schools are already reporting how federal dollars are directed in their single plan for student achievement. Now, I realize that feds have delayed this requirement for a year, but do you think we should?
So currently, we are reporting all of the dollars at the district level, the local education agency level, as well as any dollars that are distributed to the school level are reported in that single plan template. Currently, there is a plan to take where we reported those federal dollars into what we're calling a local control accountability plan addendum, so that it will be one place to look and see where the federal dollars are and where the local dollars are, the state dollars are, and then how can we braid and leverage those dollars to make the best decisions possible for students.
Sounds like a good plan. My concern here, of course, is failing to meet the federal ESSA requirements puts the $8 billion of federal funds in jeopardy. Education reform and parent groups like the reporting requirements proposed by ESSA because it's exactly the information they've been trying to get the State Board to require school districts provide in their local control and accountability plans. In your opinion, do school districts have the ability or skills to provide this school site data currently?
There are a few ways that we are currently doing that. So there's the school accountability report card where data is reported, federal as well as it has very different categories in the SARC. It's called the school accountability report card. In addition, we have an online system that we use that we are reporting by school and by district level, and that is called the consolidated application reporting system. And then there is that new local control accountability plan template that will also show the dollars, and it used to be called the LEA plan, the local education agency plan of the federal dollars.
So, okay, so has the board taken the necessary action to make sure the state will meet its requirement? And if not, what happens to the $8 billion in federal funds the state needs, just stands to lose if we don't?
So I think you're referring to the ESSA plan,
yes,
the Every Student Succeeds Act plan. And so we're in the middle of the conversation with the federal department. So we've had the first feedback from the federal department. And so staff is looking at that. We're getting ready to respond. We're in a conversation. And we feel confident that we will have a single coherent plan that addresses statute of federal as well as state statute requirements.
Great. Thank you. The Federal Department of Education recently provided feedback on the state's ESSA plan. Has the state responded to the federal government, or did we ask for an extension?
Well, we have to kind of do both because there was a timeline and they felt it was prudent that the state board looked at the feedback from the federal department. And again, it is feedback. And so we are clarifying and we are adding more charts. And again, it's a conversation and it's a process. So far, the federal department has approved about 34 plans and there's 50 states. And so we're kind of looking at the timeline on that. So there will be an they are allowing an extension, and we are taking advantage of that.
Complicated, isn't it?
It's very complicated, yes.
Yeah, as you know, education reform groups were not happy with the state's ESSA plan, and were not surprised with the federal government's response. I quote one group's response, and I quote, "The Department of Education feedback indicates that the state is systematically writing off English learners and disadvantaged students and the state's full economic potential." So my question is, what is the board's plan to address the Fed's concerns and the issues being raised by this reform group?
So two of those specific issues, when you're talking about English learners and low income, there are several things that are being done. And one is in the state's plan. What we're looking at is in the dashboard, we're actually reporting out specifically English learner progress in addition to progress on academics. So we really are looking at targeting, the 1.5 million English learners in our state. What are their needs? How are they doing? How are they acquiring language? And we are now, right now, as we speak, starting a brand new test, the English Learner Accountability, or it's called the LPAC, and I forgot the acronym, but that test is more aligned to the rigor of the standards. So we've raised the expectation of English learners, and we're helping meet that they are able to get to where they need to be. So for English learners, that's the case, as well as for low income. When we look at the data, and I'll give you an example on suspension data is going down. Which is a good thing. And if we look at the grad rates are going up, and they're going up for all groups in our state, and we are narrowing the gap. And that's important, not just that they're going up, but that we're narrowing the gap.
So you think this thing is working?
I think there's more work to be done, but it is working, and it is just starting as we look at that entire system of the four components that I spoke about earlier.
Well, thanks for coming up here today. Thanks for bringing your family up with
you.
And I'll be in strong support today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Berryhill. Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Pro Tem. Dr. Valdez and I already talked, and she answered all my questions, and Mr. Berryhill was so thorough, I have no follow-up questions. So.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Vice Chair. For those in the audience who are in support of today's nominee, please come on up. For those who are in support.
Yeah, John Winger on behalf of the California Charter School. John Winger on behalf of California Charter Schools Association in support.
Thank you.
RJ Sedwentis on behalf of the Association of California School Administrators in strong support. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Alejandro Espinosa on behalf of State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Tom Torlakson, in support.
Jeff Vaca on behalf of Riverside County Superintendent of Schools, Dr. Judy White, in strong support.
Lori Easterling on behalf of the California Teachers Association in strong support.
Any other folks in support of today's nominee? Those who are in opposition to today's nominee, Ms. Karen Valdez, I'm seeing none. Any further questions or commentaries from the members? Seeing none as well, too. Can I get a motion? We have a motion made by Mr. Berryhill himself. We have a motion made by Mr. Berryhill. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Senators Atkins.
Aye.
Atkins, aye. Berryhill.
Aye.
Berryhill, aye. Leyva.
Aye.
Leyva, aye. Cannella.
Aye.
Cannella, aye. De Leon.
Aye.
De Leon, aye.
Ms. Valdez, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Okay, well, I guess you may not know Mr. Gaffney Rivera, right? From San Francisco Mission District. No, and Mr. Duffy and Ms. Valdez, well, congratulations to all three of you guys. Nettie, did you want something else? Yeah. Yeah. You want a double vote or a double confirmation? You know? Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Okay. We have some business still. We're not in executive session right now. We're going to go back to file item number 6. And I know that one of our colleagues had a question. So let's go to file item number 6, and that would be Mr. Berryhill.
Yeah, I'm just concerned that, you know, all of a sudden we're letting everybody speak. It seems to me that foreign dignitaries were historically, on occasion, we're able to speak on the floor. I'm talking about Joan Baez, seeing a very, you could argue, political song, and I'm not sure that it's appropriate. I mean, we could have Ted Nugent up next week, and I don't, you know, singing about NRA issues, and I don't think that would go over very big. You know what I mean?
Is he the writer Cat Scratch Fever?
I think so.
It's
yes.
The one. Okay,
it's
just one.
It's just the song. I think it's his political views are probably.
Yeah.
For some of us.
Yeah.
These are point taken.
All of us.
Exactly. Yeah.
So
we have no problem at all with, you know, honoring her.
Yeah, I mean, is it appropriate to sing a song on the Senate floor versus having a reception out somewhere and sing a song? I think that's the only concern.
Were you here when the Mariachi Divas performed?
I would say that's totally different.
We weren't on the rules committee.
Totally different. At the time, you were.
Well, why don't we open, why don't we do this? Why don't we open up for, let's open up for discussion. Obviously, our colleague, Mr. Berryhill, has some consternation with regards to, I think the custom and practice has been dignitaries or what is viewed or perceived as very special guests that there has been no disagreement from Republicans allowing, if there was always an audible call that was made, you know, at a moment's notice to allow someone to speak. Why don't we have a discussion that if folks would like? Maybe they don't, you don't want to have a discussion, but let's have a discussion nonetheless, you know.
I honestly think that your point is well taken, that this might be someone. Well, I think Jen Baez is really cool.
I do too.
And I think it would be pretty cool to have her perform. I do worry that we're opening the door to future issues where folks might not be comfortable with someone performing. Maybe just an introduction would be better, and then her performing maybe in, what is it, 211 or somewhere we usually have receptions. Or the Rotunda would be great, the acoustics.
In Senator Berryhill's office, perhaps?
With one.
As painful as it is, I concur.
Okay.
I concur. Again, I don't.
You'd be the lone voice on this issue.
Yeah, it just seems inappropriate. I mean, if she goes and sings in the Rotunda, more people can watch, and, you know, I think it could be better, but I agree.
Okay, why don't we do this? Why don't we table number six? We'll table number six right now, and we'll table number six. We won't have a vote on number six, and perhaps.
Or amend it.
What would the amendment be?
Without the singing.
Without the introduction.
Yeah. And just the introduction.
Okay, what we'll do is this. We'll have an amendment. What we'll do in the amendment right now is we will table the singing part, mm-hmm. but we will make an amendment to file out number six to have her introduced on the floor. And Mr. Berryhill, if you could be so kind enough, I'll do so myself, I'll follow through. Could you have a discussion also, too, with our colleague, Mr. Monning, as well, too?
Sure.
And that'd be great. So then, obviously, I'll be getting the phone call, and I'll have a discussion as well, too. So how can we sort of accomplish the goals that are stated here and try to find a happy medium for everybody involved here? So we'll have a file item number six. As amended to allow Ms. Joan Baez to be introduced as a special guest on the floor. Can I get a motion? We have a motion made by Ms. Leyva. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Senators Atkins. Atkins, aye. Berryhill.
Aye.
Berryhill, aye. Leyva.
Aye.
Leyva, aye. Cannella.
Aye.
Cannella, aye. De Leon.
Aye.
De Leon, aye.
Motion passes. So we are going to adjourn this session, and we're going to go into an executive session.